grew up, written for your local historical society, or maybe a diary, or a journal, or a collection of letters. But whatever form it takes, long or short, formal or informal, published or unpublished, you'll find it's a satisfying thing to do. The urge to leave some record of our life, to validate how we lived and what we did, is one of the strongest human impulses. Who doesn't want to be remembered? It's also an important thing to do because you are the only custodian of your story, and that story is perishable. It's perishable because, as you've noticed if you're a parent, the next generation has a tendency not to be interested in family history until it's too late. I often hear middle-aged men and women say, "I wish I had asked my mother about that," or, "I'm sorry I didn't pay more attention to my grandfather's stories," and I always think that's very sad. To have all that information and all those stories die with the person who had the information and the stories. My father, who was a businessman with no literary pretensions, wrote both a family history and a history of the family shellac business, which stayed on the same block in the middle of Manhattan for more than 100 years. He had his 2 histories typed and bound, and he gave a copy to his 4 children, and his 3 sons-in-law, and his daughter-in-law, and his 15 grandchildren. I've always been glad he did that. First, the process of re-examining his German-American roots and his turn-of-the-century New York boyhood kept him engaged when he was an old man with few talents for self-amusement. But also, his 2 accounts have a lot of charm as social history. I find myself dipping into them surprisingly often to clear up some question about who some relative was, or to answer a query from a reporter about some quirk of New York City geography. So get your story down, and have fun doing it. You'll be glad you did, and so will your children and your grandchildren someday. How to get your story down is what I want to help you with on this recording. How to think about all the problems and the questions that confront anyone who sets out to write a memoir. The big problem, of course, is that there's much too much material. Everybody's life is a long, untidy sprawl of half-remembered memories and events. As Russell Baker put it, after wrestling with the problem in his memoir, Growing Up, the writer of an autobiographical work knows the whole iceberg, not just the tip. But the reader doesn't want your whole iceberg. Readers can't process that huge floating mass of undifferentiated stuff. They can only process a small chunk that you've extracted from the iceberg and shaped into a narrative. So when you write your memoir, you must become the editor of your own life. You must impose a manageable size and a unifying idea on your story, and throw everything else away. Remember, you're not writing an autobiography. You're only writing a memoir. It's a big difference. If you always keep that difference in mind, it will greatly simplify your job. Otherwise, writing a memoir can be overwhelming. So what is the difference between an autobiography and a memoir? Autobiography is the iceberg, the whole story. It begins, "I was born," and it moves dutifully through a person's entire life, describing every success and every setback, every career achievement, every man and woman and child, and every animal, it often seems, who crossed the person's path, skipping nothing. Which is why most autobiographies are such big books. You can't read them in bed without denting your stomach. Memoir doesn't care about the whole life. It assumes the whole life. Memoir narrows the lens and focuses on one period in the writer's life that was unusually intense or colorful or influential, most often its childhood, or that was framed by some historical or social situation like war or poverty or a depression or foreign service. That narrowness of focus is what makes memoirs so appealing. It's why we like them so much. A memoir is a self-contained story set in a particularly interesting time and place. Like what, you say? Well, here are a half dozen good memoirs that come to mind. Angela's Ashes, Frank McCourt's memoir of his squalid boyhood in an Irish slum. The book is grounded in the condition of poverty, Without the poverty, there wouldn't be any book. When that boyhood ends with McCourt's arrival in America at the age of 19, the memoir ends, and that's where we want it to end. We've been told a story that has its own proper shape. We don't want to read what Frank McCourt did after he got to America. That's a whole other book. Growing Up by Russell Baker is a box inside a box. It's the memoir of an American boy being brought up by his newly widowed mother, set inside the larger story of a family being battered by the Depression. The book takes its great strength from its historical context, America in the 1930s, which was like no other time in America before or since. So it's not only a wonderful memoir, one family's battle against financial hardship, it's also one of the best books about the American Depression. The Road from Kurrain by Jill Kerr Conway is a memoir about Conway's isolated girlhood on a sheep station in the outback of Australia, and about the 7-year drought that killed her parents' homesteading dream and ended up killing her father, and about her struggle to extricate herself from a suffocating male society and to start over in America. In America, she became president of Smith College, but again, that story, her academic success as an adult, isn't told in this book. Conway's memoir ends when she gets on the plane in Sydney, when she escapes. And what we remember, because the setting is so exotic and so concentrated, is the country she escaped from, its remoteness and its harshness and its impact on her family. Speak Memory by Vladimir Nabokov is the most elegant memoir I know. It recalls Nabokov's golden boyhood in the St. Petersburg of the Tsars, a world of private tutors and summer houses that the Russian Revolution would end forever. It's an act of writing frozen in a unique time and place. That boyhood can never happen again. Fierce Attachments by Vivian Gornick is a memoir of a girl growing up in the Bronx, attached, fiercely, to her mother and to the small rituals of everyday life in one apartment building on one block, but also impatient to outgrow the mother and the building and the block. When I think of that memoir, I'm back in that Bronx apartment. A Cab at the Door is a memoir by the English writer V.S. Pritchett about a boyhood that was almost Dickensian in his grim apprenticeship to the London leather trade. Yet Pritchett describes it without self-pity and even with a certain merriment, and we come to understand that the hardship of his boyhood was what made him the humane and compassionate writer he grew up to be. His boyhood was inseparably joined to the time and the country and the class he was born into. So think small when you write about your past. Remember, memoir isn't the summing up of a life. It's a window into a life at a certain moment. It's like a photograph in its composition, in its selection of important details. One of the narrowest memoirs I know is Operating Instructions by Anne Lamott, which is a journal she kept of the first year in the life of her son, Sam. When Sam was born, Lamott was a California single mother in her mid-30s. A recovering drug and alcohol addict, and her book is an equal mixture of exhaustion and wonder. She writes about the fatigue and the loneliness and the fear and the anger that go with taking care of a new baby alone. She's hard on both her present self and her former hippie self. But she also writes with gratitude and with humor and with a strong current of Christian faith. So the woman we gradually get to know isn't some Bay Area flake, as she might well come across, but a believable woman, often exasperating, but also likable. Now, technically, you might say that's not a memoir, because Anne Lamott didn't write it retrospectively. She just made a literary arrangement of the journal she kept at the time. But it feels like a memoir, because we're taken back to one period in the writer's life, just one year, and we're caught up in a story that couldn't be older and couldn't be newer. One baby's incremental processing of the world and the support that the baby and its mother get from their friends and neighbors. In other words, there's no one right way to write your memoir. If you make an honest connection with some portion of your past, you got yourself a memoir. A similar example is Naples 44 by the great British travel writer Norman Lewis, which is one of the best books about World War II. It originated as a journal that Lewis kept during 1 year, 1944, when he was a British intelligence officer dealing with the destitute population of Naples right after the Allied armies landed in Italy. He found Naples so reduced by air raids that ordinary life had come to a stop. There was no water and no electricity and almost no food. The grace with which the Neapolitans began to reclaim their lives is Lewis's subject. Because his humanity connected with their humanity, his book has a compassion that's not often found in the literature of military occupation. Actually, Lewis's book wasn't published until 1978. I guess he just put his journal in a drawer for 30 years. But it works as a memoir because it makes a connection between who Norman Lewis was at a certain age in a certain place and the people of Naples who made that time and that place unique. If you do that in your memoir, if you make an honest connection with an important moment in your past, you're bound to make a connection with your readers, because they have similar memories of emotional moments in their own lives. I was also in Italy in 1944, in Naples, an American GI also contending with the human residue of all that bombing. So Naples 44 is a gift from Norman Lewis to me. It returns me to my younger self, to the 22-year-old soldier I was in the same shattered city. So pay attention to the journals and the diaries and the letters you wrote when you were younger. Get them out and see if they contain the seeds of a memoir, some long-forgotten events and thoughts and emotions, some point of departure into your past. Never forget that what you have to sell as a writer, your product, is yourself, you. I'll read almost anybody's memoir if it's written with honesty. For me, no other form of nonfiction writing goes so deeply to the roots of human experience, to all the drama and all the pain and the humor and the unexpectedness of life. Now, what do I mean when I say I'll read anyone's memoir if it's written with honesty? To explain that, I have to talk for a moment about the remarkable rise of memoir in America today. It's the hot form in America today, a product of our talk show culture and our obsession with intimate personal details. Never have personal narratives gushed so profusely out of the American soil. Everybody has a story to tell, and everybody is telling it. The result is that this is the best of times for memoir. Many good ones are being written. And also the worst of times for memoir. Many bad ones are being written. The form has never been so admired and so reviled. It used to be the custom not so long ago for memoir writers to stop short of stark reality, to cloak with modesty their most private and their most shameful memories. Today, no remembered episode is too sordid, no family too dysfunctional, to be trotted out for the wonderment of the masses in books and in magazines and on radio and TV talk shows. The good side of the memoir boom, its ultimate symbol, is Frank McCourt's Angela's Ashes. In its literary shape, it's a classic memoir, recalling a specific time and place in the writer's life, his boyhood in Ireland. It also hit the double jackpot of critical and commercial success, winning the Pulitzer Prize and perching at the top of the bestseller list for several years. And it's also the perfect product of our confessional times, sharing with its readers the most degrading facts about growing up in the slums of Limerick. The marvel of Frank McCourt's childhood is that he survived it, as he himself notes in the third sentence of his book. But the other marvel is that he was able to triumph over his childhood with an act of writing, beating back the past with grace and humor and with the power of language. Those qualities, grace and humor and language, by which I mean good English, are at the heart of all the good memoirs of recent years, books like Pete Hamill's A Drinking Life and Mary Carr's The Liar's Club, and Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life. Anyone might think that the alcoholism and the violence and the domestic chaos that enveloped those writers when they were young would have long ago hardened their heart. Both Mary Carr and Tobias Wolff were lugged around the country by barely competent mothers running away from unstable males and taking up with men who were even worse, terrible new stepfathers for children whose real fathers abandoned them. Yet both of them look back with compassion. "My mother didn't read this book until it was complete," Mary Carr writes in her preface. "However, for 2 years she freely answered questions and did research for me, even when she was ill. She has been unreserved in her encouragement of this work, though much in the story pains her. Her bravery is laudable. Her support means everything." Tobias Wolff also withheld his memoir from his mother until it was done, and he was nervous about how she would react to his unflinching account of her behavior. He said, "My mother didn't get anything in her life right, except one thing, and that was love. After she read the book, she said, 'I'm glad you didn't tidy me up and turn me into someone I wasn't. That would have meant I hadn't been of any use to you as a mother.'" If these books by Frank McCourt and Pete Hamill and Mary Carr and Tobias Wolff represent the modern memoir at its best, it's because they were written with love. They elevate the pain of the past with forgiveness, and thereby arrive at a larger truth about families in various stages of brokenness. There's no whining in these memoirs, no self-pity, no craving for revenge. These writers want us to know we are not victims. We come from a tribe of fallible people, prisoners of our own destructiveness, and we've survived to tell the story without judgment and to get on with our lives. That kind of forbearance, however, no longer seems to be an American virtue. The modern appetite for true confession has loosed a torrent of memoirs that are little more than therapy. The writer is using the memoir form to bash their parents and their relatives and society, and to wallow in the lurid details of their struggle with drink, drug addiction, and rape, and sexual abuse, and incest, and anorexia, obesity, codependency, depression, attempted suicide, and all the other fashionable talk show syndromes. I'm not saying that stuff isn't hard, of course it is, but writing has its own codes of discipline and honor. And all those victimhood stories are what's giving memoirs a bad name. If memoir has become nothing but an outlet for self-pity and reprisal, for venting old anger and nursing old wounds and settling old grudges, it must be a degraded form, so the argument goes. So how should you think about that? What's the answer to that problem? The answer is that memoir writing, like every kind of writing, comes in both good and bad varieties. There are good memoirs, and there are bad memoirs. That's the only issue that finally matters. Whether the authors of certain notorious recent memoirs ought to have written those books, breaking powerful taboos and social covenants, isn't the point. When Katherine Harrison wrote The Kiss, a memoir of her affair with her father, the critics devoted so much space to scolding her for writing it and telling her she had violated the privacy of her children, which was none of their business, that they hardly got around to discussing the book. The only pertinent literary question about any memoir is it a good book or a bad book? So what makes a good memoir? What are the ingredients? I think there are two main elements to writing a good memoir. One is a matter of art, the other is a matter of craft. First, art. By art, I mean integrity, integrity of intention. Intention is what we wish to accomplish with our writing. Call it the writer's soul. Writers can write to affirm and to celebrate, or they can write to debunk and to destroy and to scandalize. The choice is ours. Nobody can make us write what we don't want to write. We get to keep intention. How does that apply to memoir? Memoir is the best search mechanism that writers are given. Writing about your life is how you try to make sense of who you are and who you once were and what heritage and what values shaped you. If you seriously embark on that quest, if you use memoir to look for your own humanity and the humanity of the people who crossed your life, however much pain they may have caused you, readers will be nourished by your journey because they'll recognize similar elements of humanity and pain from their own lives. So get your intention clear before you start. Tell your story with integrity, and readers will connect with that. What they won't connect with is whining and self-pity. Get all that leftover anger resolved in some other way. Writing to complain and to retaliate and to shock can be as destructive to the writer as it is to the person being destroyed. Second, craft. The other element you need for a good memoir is carpentry, hammer and nails. We like to think that an interesting life will write itself, that all you have to do is tell your story and it will just fall into place on the page. It won't. Life is much too disorganized. We like to think that Thoreau went home to Concord and just wrote up his notes about what he did at Walden Pond for 2 years. He didn't. He wrote 7 drafts of Walden in 8 years, piecing together a memoir that, to us, seems casual and even chatty. Thoreau wasn't a woodsman when he went to the woods. He was a writer. And by making a careful literary arrangement of what he did and thought and felt at Walden Pond, he wrote one of our sacred texts. In your memoir, you must manufacture a text. You must construct a narrative that's so orderly and so tight and so interesting that readers will follow it easily and want to keep reading. You must, in short, be a craftsman. You must practice the craft of telling a story. You can never forget the storyteller's ancient rules of maintaining pace and tension and momentum, rules you've known in your bones since you were a child, having bedtime stories read to you. Those stories pulled you along without any delays and detours. Your memoir has to exert the same kind of pull. So let me just sum that up. A good memoir requires 2 ingredients. One is integrity, setting out with the intention of being true to your best self. The other is carpentry, constructing an interesting and a coherent narrative. Now, one of the oddities of writing a memoir, which you should know about before we go on, is that when you've done all this, when you've constructed your story, you'll arrive at a version of your life that's yours and nobody else's. It's not quite like that of any other person who was present at the same events. This phenomenon, the fact that the same past has many different owners, was first revealed to me, many years ago, when I was invited to write 1/5 of a book. It was called 5 Boyhoods, and it consisted of memoirs written by 5 men who grew up in successive decades of the 20th century. The first chapter, by Howard Lindsay, described his turn-of-the-century boyhood in Atlantic City, a sunny Victorian world very much like the one he'd later inhabit as the co-author and star of one of Broadway's longest-running plays, Life with Father. The second chapter, by Harry Golden, described his boyhood in the Jewish ghetto of New York's Lower East Side, a world as crowded as Lindsay's was spacious. Chapter 3 was by Walt Kelly, the creator of Pogo, who came from an Irish clan that was in perpetual migration between Philadelphia and Bridgeport, Connecticut. My chapter was about a boyhood spent in a vale of prosperous wasps on the north shore of Long Island, and the last chapter, by John Updike, described growing up as the only child of 2 schoolteachers in a small town in Pennsylvania. 5 boyhoods, as different as American boyhoods could be. Yet what struck me when the book came out was how many themes they had in common. 1 was loneliness, the universal plight. Another was humor, the universal solvent. I mention this to remind you that all good memoirs, however crazy or bizarre they may seem in some of their details, are grounded in universal truths. So when you write your memoir, don't reach for the outlandish. Don't try to be too funny. Don't exaggerate what a character your aunt was. Tell us what happened and let us think, that's outlandish, or that's funny, or what a character. But mainly what I discovered by writing Five Boyhoods is that memory, which we think is such a reliable writer's tool, is infinitely variable, depending on who's doing the remembering. The child's remembered truth is almost always different from his parents' remembered truth. My mother, after she read my chapter, cried because my memory of my boyhood was less golden than her memory of my boyhood. Had I subconsciously reinvented it to make it more lonely than it really was? Had she, subconsciously, never noticed? One of the people I described in my memoir was my grandmother, Frieda Zinser, who was a stern presence in our lives. As a second-generation German, she hadn't lost the Germanic relish for telling people off, and she had a full supply of didactic German maxims to reinforce the message. She was a woman of fierce pride, bent on cultural improvement for herself and her children and her grandchildren, and in my memoir I duly noted her strength. But I also made it clear that she was no fun. After Five Boyhoods came out, my mother tried to set me straight. Grandma wasn't really like that, she said, defending the mother-in-law who had made her own life far from easy. She was unhappy and quite shy, and she really wanted to be liked. Well, maybe so. The truth is somewhere between my mother's version and mine. But she was like that to me. That was my truth. And usually that's the only truth a memoir writer can work with. How the people and the events in your past appeared to you at the age when you knew them. The memoir I wrote for Five Boyhoods turned out to be about a boy dealing with certain kinds of isolation, which were not my parents' fault. They wanted only the best for us. They had built a pleasant house with a lot of porches overlooking Long Island Sound. My father's business withstood the Depression, so my three older sisters and I were sheltered from its cold winds. But the pleasant house was 2 miles from the nearest town, and not near any other house. I wanted to live on a block like everybody else, doing block things. I was also the only boy for miles around. By some fluke of Mendel's law, no boys had been born to any of the nearby families. It was a neighborhood of girls, and that's what our house was full of, my sisters and their friends giggling over girlish secrets, talking a language full of mysteries. One of the first words I can remember hearing was organdy. I never knew what it meant, and never dared to ask. I was also the smallest of boys, late to grow, living in a world of girls who shot up like mutants, blonde Amazons by the age of 12. The gap was worst at the dances I was made to attend, which had optimistic names like the junior get-togethers. The tribal rules of New York society required every boy to bring a gardenia to the girl who invited him, which she would pin to the bosom of her gown. For me, too young to appreciate the bosom, I was just tall enough for my nose to be pressed into the gardenia I had brought to adorn it. The sickly smell of that flower was like chloroform to me as the girl and I lurched endlessly around the dance floor. Talk was out of the question. My tall partner was just as isolated and resentful. I thought those nights would never end. In Five Boyhoods, I cloaked those unhappy memories in humor. Humor is the memoir writer's armor against the hard truths and the hard emotions. Certainly it's the salvation of Angela's ashes. Probably the only way Frank McCourt could stand to recall his childhood, and we can stand to read about it, is that he tells his story with so much humor. Probably I also use humor as a kindness to my family. When I started writing, I was half paralyzed by the thought that my parents and my sisters were looking over my shoulder, if not actually perched there, monitoring every word that came out of my typewriter. My first drafts were stiff, and I never really relaxed. Since then, reading other people's memoirs, I've often wondered how many silent passengers were along on the ride, subtly improving the past. You will also feel the presence of these censors when you start writing your memoir, and you'll also be inhibited. Can I really tell that story? What will my sister think? But you can't keep looking over your shoulder. You must get on with your story as you remember it. Again, it comes down to integrity. If you play fair with the truth, even if certain episodes are painful to your family, you are likely to get their blessing, or at least their approval, for what you tried to do. Every family wants to have some kind of record kept of its effort to be a family. Okay, so much for general principles and attitudes and hazards of the memoir form. Let's get down to work. You're ready to write your memoir. You've been thinking about it for a long time. Now you're eager to start. You found that old trunk with all the old postcards and letters and snapshots, the high school yearbooks and college yearbooks and football programs and dance programs and theater programs, the wedding announcements and baby shower invitations. Your life is there waiting for you in scraps of paper and scraps of memory. Now all you have to do is put it together. How should you begin? Many people ask me that question when they reach a certain age, when they begin to feel a few twinges of accountability or arthritis. How should I go about it, they say. What I tell them, and what I'm about to tell you, isn't what they expect, because we're starting from different assumptions. They assume that they already know what their memoir is going to be about, what experiences it will cover, and what scenario it will follow. I don't think writing works that way, especially memoir. Writing doesn't follow the roadmaps you make in advance. Beware of about. The act of writing your memoir will gradually tell you what it's about. So here's my advice on how to begin. Go to your desk on Monday morning and think of some event in your past that's unusually vivid in your memory. Your first day at summer camp, the first time your father took you to a ball game, your senior prom, your high school graduation, an encounter with a teacher, an athletic contest, a music recital, the day you joined the army, the birth of a child, a moment of triumph, a moment of humiliation, a moment of love, whatever, as long as it's still vivid in your memory. Call that memory back and write it up. Describe what happened and how you felt about it. What you write doesn't have to be long. 1 page, 2 pages, 5 pages, but it should be complete in itself. One episode with a beginning and an end. When you finish, put what you've written in a folder and get on with your life. Take a walk, go to work, pick up the kids. On Tuesday morning, do it again. Tuesday's vivid memory doesn't have to have any relation to Monday's memory. If you wrote on Monday about your first day in the Army, what you write on Tuesday doesn't have to be about your second day in the Army. It might be some incident that happened when you were 8. Take whatever memory comes that day. Put entirely out of your mind the idea that you're embarking on some larger writing project, a memoir or an article or a book. Write up Tuesday's vivid memory and put it in the folder. Do that every day, at the same time if you can. After a while, the entries will begin to add up. They still may not fall into any relationship to each other. That's okay. But they're doing useful work. First, you're exercising new muscles. Recall muscles, writing muscles, organizing muscles. Second, you're discovering that the subconscious mind plays a big role in this kind of writing, that one memory leads to another. Whenever I write about my past, I'm amazed by how often the physical act of writing summons back some long-forgotten person or incident just when I need it. Talking into a tape recorder doesn't seem to do the job. It has to be a physical act of writing, pen or pencil or computer. Get to know this wonderful function of the mind. It's a godsend to anyone writing a memoir. If you stick to your daily routine, you'll be delighted by all the material your mind will begin to feed you when you turn it on in the morning. While you slept, your subconscious mind didn't. It was busy rummaging around in all those memories that you stirred up, and dredging up other people and places and events from your past. Be grateful for these ghosts making a return appearance. Keep this up for 2 months, or 3 months, or 4. Trust the process as long as you can stand it. Don't fidget. Don't be impatient to start writing your memoir, the one you had in mind before you began. Then one day take all your entries out of the folder and spread them out on the floor and see what you've written. Here are some of the things you'll discover. You'll discover that your first entries were quite stiff and self-conscious. That's normal. Every person who sits down to write sits down to commit an act of literature. And the person who emerges on paper is far stiffer than the person who sat down to write. All of us, including professional writers, need a certain amount of time, often quite a lot of time, to relax and to find our natural voice. Therefore, you'll notice that the entries you wrote in the second month are warmer and more natural than the ones you wrote in the first month, which are a little wooden, a little impersonal, maybe a little pretentious, a little looking over your shoulder to see who's watching. As I said, that's normal. In fact, you may never use much of what you wrote in the first month. But that writing wasn't wasted. You couldn't have arrived at the confidence of the second month without doing the work of the first month, the stretching exercises. So you'll gradually begin to find your style, the person you want to sound like, the person you really are. If you don't find that person, you won't write a memoir anyone will want to read. All writing is talking to someone else on paper. Talk like yourself. You will make similar discoveries in the area of content, what to put in and what to leave out. You will notice certain themes and patterns emerging in the entries you've written. Your material will begin to tell you how it should be put together. It will tell you this is a good direction and a good voice. It's true, it's funny, it's interesting, stay with it. It will also tell you this is not interesting. It's not as interesting as you thought it was. In fact, it's pretty boring. Or it will tell you this is a digression. It's not relevant to the main thread of your story. In short, you'll begin to glimpse what your memoir is really about and what it's not about. That's a crucial thing to discover, what your memoir is not about, as the writer Annie Dillard once explained, describing how she wrote her memoir, An American Childhood, about growing up in Pittsburgh. She said, "In the course of writing this memoir, I've learned all sorts of things, quite inadvertently, about myself and about various relationships. But these things are not important to the book, and I easily leave them out. I leave out many things that were important to my life, but of no concern for the book, like the summer I spent in Wyoming when I was 15. I keep the action in Pittsburgh. I see no reason to drag everybody off to Wyoming just because I want to tell them about my summer vacation." You have to take pains in a memoir not to hang on the reader's arm like a drunk and say, "And then I did this, and it was so interesting." One way to think about that important point of Annie Dillard's, deciding what to leave out of your memoir, is to keep your unities intact. In this case, unity of place. Annie Dillard's memoir is about a childhood in Pittsburgh, so she eliminates everything that didn't happen in Pittsburgh. Angela's Ashes is essentially confined to the town of Limerick. If Frank McCourt went anywhere else during his boyhood, he doesn't break his unity by telling us about it. Nabokov's Speak Memory is about growing up in St. Petersburg. Alfred Kazin's A Walker in the City is about growing up in Brooklyn. Vivian Gornick's Fierce Attachments is about growing up in the Bronx. Andre Aciman's Out of Egypt is about growing up in Alexandria. Henry Louis Gates Jr.'s Colored People is about growing up in Piedmont, West Virginia. All those powerful memoirs take much of their power from their sense of place, one distinctive place. When I think of those books, I see those places and hear their sounds and smell their smells. So remember unity of place when you're trying to decide what to put in and what to leave out. Don't drag us off to Wyoming if Pittsburgh is your story. Once you've finally found the proper shape and content of your memoir, you will begin to write in a more organized way, constructing a coherent narrative. And you can stop using my manila folder method. the exercise I suggested to get you warmed up. But remember that that random method is always there for you to use as a search mechanism. Your memory is your best source of material when your other wells go dry. So that's how I want you to get started. Try it. Start today. I think you'll be amazed and delighted by how much of your past comes back to you when you go looking for it with a daily act of writing. To sum that up, don't be in a hurry to find a shape and a storyline for your memoir. Take the time to just poke around in your memory and in your subconscious mind and let your memoir find you. Trust the process. If the process is sound, the product will take care of itself. Now I want to say something about roots. Writing a memoir is, in one way or another, a search for our roots, for our heritage. So it's the perfect form, I think, for anyone who has come to America from somewhere else. Minorities, immigrants, children of immigrants, or for anyone who feels dislocated or disenfranchised, anyone who feels like an outsider in America. Writing about the experience of being an outsider is one way to get control over it, to come to terms with the alien customs of the new country and the powerful tug of the abandoned past, of the country that's been left behind. Here's a passage by a Chinese-American writer, Maxine Hong Kingston, the daughter of immigrants, who grew up in Stockton, California. In this memoir, from her book The Woman Warrior, she recalls the shyness and the embarrassment of being a child starting school in a strange new land. "When I went to kindergarten and had to speak English for the first time," she writes, "I became silent. I spoke to no one at school, did not ask before going to the lavatory, and flunked kindergarten. At first it did not occur to me I was supposed to talk or to pass kindergarten. I talked at home and to one or two of the Chinese kids in class. I made motions and even made some jokes. I drank out of a toy saucer when the water spilled out of the cup, and everybody laughed, pointed at me, so I did it some more. I didn't know that Americans don't drink out of saucers. It was when I found out I had to talk that school became a misery, that the silence became a misery. I did not speak and felt bad each time I did not speak, but I read aloud in first grade and heard the barest whisper with little squeaks come out of my throat. 'Louder,' said the teacher, who scared the voice away again. The other Chinese girls didn't talk either, so I knew the silence had to do with being a Chinese girl." Well, that childhood whisper is now an adult writer's voice that speaks to us with humor and wisdom, and I'm grateful to have it in our midst. Nobody but a Chinese-American woman writer could make me, a white American male, feel what it's like to be a Chinese girl plunked down in an American kindergarten and expected to be an American girl. Memoir is how we try to explain to ourselves and to each other the cultural differences that are a painful fact of everyday life in this complicated country. So use it to help you do that job. If you're an outsider, write your way back through those moments of severance from your past, and they'll begin to make more sense to you. If you're a teacher with pupils who have arrived from other countries, put them to writing mini-memoirs. Show them how they can use writing to sort out what they're going through. Here's another passage by a woman writer, Kennedy Fraser, a white woman, but in her eyes an outsider, making herself vulnerable to us in a memoir, Ornament and Silence, and explaining how she has been sustained, rescued really, by the memoirs of other women. "There was a time when my life seemed so painful to me," she writes, "that reading about the lives of other women writers was one of the few things that could help. In my early 30s, I would sit in an armchair reading books about these other lives. Sometimes when I came to the end, I would sit down and read the book through from the beginning again. Even now, I feel I should pretend that I was reading these women's fiction or their poetry, their lives as they chose to present them, alchemized as art. But that would be a lie," she continues. It was the private messages I really liked. The journals and letters and autobiographies and biographies, when they seemed to be telling the truth. I needed all this murmured chorus, this continuum of true life stories, to see me through. They were like mothers and sisters to me, these literary women, many of them already dead. They seemed to stretch out a hand. I had come to New York, as so many had when I was young, in order to invent myself. And like many modern women, I had catapulted out of my context. The successes of the women writers gave me hope. Yet it was the desperate bits I liked best, the secret, shameful things, the pain, the abortions and misalliances, the pills they took, the amount they drank. Now, what I'd like you to remember about that passage is how available Kennedy Fraser makes herself to us. I don't think there's any woman who won't relate to some of those emotions. To write a good memoir, you must make yourself available. I don't mean you have to reveal every dark secret and shameful memory. Leave that to all those memoir writers of the talk show school, the spill everything school, the victims and the whiners and the avengers. But don't confuse modesty with false modesty. Many memoir writers keep themselves so buttoned up that there's nobody on the page for us to see. It's the old self-esteem problem that keeps so many people from expressing their best selves, especially women. Nobody cares what I think, they say, or who would be interested in my life. We'll care. Your life will be interesting if you tell us about interesting people you've known. People are at the heart of every good memoir. All the crazy uncles and wicked stepfathers, the memorable teachers and the irascible coaches, the neighbors and townspeople and all their unique peculiarity. Bring those people back to life. Make them as memorable for us as they were for you. But finally, the most interesting person in a memoir, we hope, will be the person who wrote it, you. What did you do? What did you think? What did you learn from the hills and valleys of life? So please, make yourself available. Don't hide. If you're going to hide, you might as well not write a memoir. You might as well stay in bed. One memoir writer who got himself in big trouble by hiding was Russell Baker. His memoir, Growing Up, as I mentioned earlier, is about a boy growing up with his widowed mother in the Depression. Baker once described how he went about writing that memoir. Because he was a lifelong newspaper man, he said, he got out his tape recorder and tracked down all his relatives who lived through the Depression and interviewed them. Then, he said, I started writing, and what I wrote was a reporter's book in which I quoted these elderly people about what life was like long ago in that time and place. I was reporting my own life, and being the good journalist, I kept myself out of it. And because I was uneasy about what had always been an awkward relationship with my mother, and because she wasn't there to testify for herself, I kept her out of it. And I wrote a rather long book. I think it ran to 450 pages. I was very pleased with it, and I sent it off to my agent and my editor, and I thought, well, I'll give them 24 hours to sit up all night and read it, and they'll phone me back tomorrow. But nobody called the next day, Baker said, or the next week, or the next month, and he began to sense that something was wrong. One night, he said, I took the manuscript out of the drawer and sat down to read. I nodded off on about page 20, and I thought, if I can't read this thing... But by that time I had made a second judgment myself, that the book was in terrible shape, and I knew what was wrong with it. My mother wasn't in it. There were all these interesting relatives, the uncles and aunts, but it really was nothing but journalism, reminiscences about yesterday. I had lunch with my agent, he says, and told him it was a book about a boy and his mother, about the tension between a child and his mother, and that I would rewrite the whole thing. My agent said he thought that was right, that I had made a grievous mistake in trying to write a book about myself, in which I didn't appear. He didn't realize the strength of the mother character as I did, and I knew that if I made her the hinge on which everything swung, the book would be a story. I had been dishonest about my mother. What I had written, though it was accurate, was dishonest because of what I had left out. Just at that time, Russell Baker's son happened to come upon a trunk full of mementos that Baker's mother had kept. He brought Baker some documents from the trunk, highly emotional documents that told him many things about his mother that he had never known. They also cleared up some family mysteries that had always baffled him. He was 54 at the time. Everything suddenly fell into place, Russell Baker said, and made a story. The question was, could I write this? I hadn't written it in the first version, and it made that book a lie. So I determined that I would write that story. I thought, if I want to honor my mother in this book, it must be truthful. But I did it with great trepidation. I decided that although nobody's life makes any sense, if you're going to make a book out of it, you might as well make it into a story. I remember saying to my wife, I am now going upstairs to invent the story of my life. And I rewrote almost that whole book in about 6 months. Well, if you've read Growing Up, you know that Baker's mother is a remarkable woman and that the book rings true. If Baker did any inventing, it was to construct a narrative, altering a time sequence, maybe, or collapsing several events into one event, or heightening a personality trait, things like that. In other words, he may have altered some facts, but he didn't violate the truth. Like a playwright or a screenwriter, he compressed his story to keep it moving and to give it dramatic shape. As a memoir writer, you can never forget that you are the protagonist, not the hero. Most people who write memoirs are uncomfortable with that. They weren't trying to be a hero in their life, and they don't feel like a hero. But you are the protagonist of your own story, the central figure, and you must give yourself a plot and a setting, a landscape. A memoir I like that does this job well is Virgin Time, In Search of the Contemplative Life, by Patricia Hampel. Hampel describes her narrow Roman Catholic girlhood in Minnesota, her rebellion against all that as a young woman, and her return in middle age to religious faith, which leads to her decision to write a book about going in search of the contemplative life. As she starts to write the book, this book, she realizes that, like it or not, she's the protagonist and she must put herself in motion and go where she'll get stories. At that point, she says, the memoirist essentially becomes a travel writer. Think about that. Every writer of a memoir has to become, to some extent, a travel writer to generate some kind of journey, because all life is a journey. In this case, Hampel embarks on a pilgrimage that takes her first to Assisi, where she lives in a Franciscan monastery, and ends when she goes on retreat in a monastery of silent nuns in California. Like Russell Baker, she made up a story for herself. When you write your memoir, as I said before, you can't hide. Another story of hiding is told by Eileen Simpson, the author of Poets in Their Youth, a memoir in which she describes the period when she was a shy young graduate student married to the poet John Berryman, and was therefore also married to that whole tight circle of famously self-destructive poets like Robert Lowell and Randall Jarrell and Delmore Schwartz. Because those poets were so articulate, she just sat and listened, not knowing quite what to make of them. And she didn't start writing her memoir until she was in her 50s. By then she was a published author and a practicing psychotherapist. Recalling how she wrote her memoir, Eileen Simpson said, I was like an anthropologist who studies a tribe and reports what she finds, trying to be as objective as possible. Those poets were like a tribe. They were as exotic to me as the people Margaret Mead wrote about. I had never met people of such complexity. They weren't like other people, and they were like each other. My problem was how to tell the truth about them without patronizing them or focusing on pathology. I was writing a memoir, not a psychological study. My aim was to recapture the excitement of those extremely gifted young men, to make them as attractive to the reader as they had been to me. My first draft was a near disaster, she says. My editor sent it back and said, you aren't in the book enough. What I had left out was my take on it. My editor said, you were there, you were involved, you have to tell us what you thought and what you felt. I put the manuscript aside and didn't look at it for 3 months. Then I read it straight through and I thought, I don't know why my editor even bothered to talk to me about this version. It's so wooden. I was in a funk for about 3 days. Then I decided I'm going to rewrite it, and I rewrote the whole book from beginning to end with hardly a glance back at what I had done before. This time, Eileen Simpson continues, I wrote in a much more confident tone. In my first draft, the writing had been timorous. I was the 23-year-old girl sitting at the feet of these great men. When my editor told me to put myself in the book, I began to write as the older woman I now was, not as the tentative young faculty wife. It's an easy trap for a memoir writer to fall into. You're trying to reconstruct something that happened when you were much more unformed. But as an artist, you have to be true to the older and wiser person you have become. Well, I told you that story for several reasons. One is its similarity to Russell Baker's story of having to rewrite his entire memoir because he didn't put himself in it. And they're not alone, these total rewriters. They've got a lot of company. Here's another member of the Rewrite Club, Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Gates first wrote his memoir, Colored People, as a series of letters to his two young daughters, trying to tell them what it was like to grow up in the black community of Piedmont, West Virginia. And when he finished, he put the manuscript aside, and when he later went back to it, he realized that the voice he had chosen was completely wrong. He saw that he would have to rewrite the whole book, not in a letter-writing voice, but in a prose that suggested his father's storytelling voice, a voice he remembered with affection from his boyhood, hearing his father tell stories about how that tightly knit community went about its living and its loving. Gates said, I wanted to write a book that imitated the specialness of black culture when no white people are around. So don't be surprised if what happened to Russell Baker and Eileen Simpson and Henry Louis Gates, Jr. also happens to you. If you finish your first draft and then realize that your memoir is essentially false, that you didn't make yourself available, or that you weren't honest about the people in your life and how you felt about them, or that your voice was the wrong one for the story you had to tell. It happens to the best writers over and over. Don't be surprised, but also don't be discouraged. Rewriting is the essence of writing, a fact of the craft that all professional writers take for granted. Most of us probably spend more time rewriting than writing. The good news is that when you rewrite your memoir, it will go quickly and confidently, almost inevitably, as it did for Baker and Simpson and Gates. This time they knew they were on the right narrative path, talking in the right voice. And the story they had inside them, the story they wanted to tell all along, just tumbled out. Another reason I quoted Eileen Simpson is that she gives you a different view on a question I raised earlier, whether you should write your memoir in the voice of your younger self, the person you were when the events took place, or in the voice of the older and wiser woman or man you are now. In my own memoir, as I told you, I went for the younger self. I described my Germanic grandmother as a strict presence when I was young. My mother, who understood the causes of my grandmother's unhappiness, explained that my grandmother was really quite shy and wanted to be liked. Of course, when I grew up, I understood those causes too. But the intention of my memoir was to recall how the people in my boyhood seemed to me when I was a boy. That was my writer's truth. Eileen Simpson makes the opposite case. Her younger self, she feels, wasn't much of a self. She was only a passive listener, dazzled by the wit and charm of the poets, but not competent to understand them. Only as an older woman, with the clinical experience of a psychotherapist, could she write about the poets with knowledge and insight? Because of that clinical insight, poets in their youth is the definitive group portrait of those poets in their golden years. So it's a double memoir. On one level, it's a personal history, Eileen Simpson recalling who she was at a unique moment in her life. On another level, it's a major contribution to the study of 20th century poetry. So those are two different approaches to the question of the memoir writer's voice. My solution, I think, was the right one for me, and Eileen Simpson's was the right one for her. Your solution will be the right one for you. There's no one right way to do this highly subjective kind of writing. Again, to sum up, it comes down to trusting the process and not deciding in advance what your memoir will be about. Give your memoir time to find you. Don't push it. I've become such a nut on this matter of giving yourself enough time that I built a whole course around it, which I teach at the new school in New York, called People and Places. I want to tell you one story from that course, because I think it will lock into place